Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk, delivered on Sunday, January 19th, 2025, is by Dr. Becky Manning on the topic of restoring ecosystem health.
The Fund for North Bennington is a not-for-profit volunteer organization that over the last five decades has supported virtually all facets of the village of North Bennington, ranging from the school strings program to an emergency COVID wrangler to handle the paperwork and the testing for organizations in the town when that blight hit us, and the outdoor sculpture garden show every year. So it's a very busy organization, lots of activities, and it also owns 420 plus acres of both forested and open land. You're all probably familiar with the Mile Around Woods and the fields that are near them, and up in the back, all the woodlands around that. And then the Frost Trail, the property coming from the Frost House over to the lake and over to the pavilion, that's also fund property. So about 2019, and I remember that year specifically because of the two reasons we took on, started this project. This is a 10-year project. Of course, that's an illusion. This is an unending project. And the goal of the project, which I'll get to in more detail, is to do what we can as humans to mitigate the damage that we have done as humans, and to try to give the habitat some breathing space to regenerate naturally. That is our goal. So I'm going to talk about why, just told you most of the reasons why we started the project, what we've done so far, what our successes have been, and what, you know, those challenges just keep coming down the pike. So in 2019, Science, the journal Science, published a report saying that if you were alive in 1970, in your lifetime, you have seen the loss of one in every four birds in North America. This is 3 billion birds. This is in 2019, and the trend line is just as precipitous. This has occurred across all species of birds, and this has occurred in every biome, meaning desert or oceanside or mountains or prairie. So that was alarming. The second major facet that butted up against that was a site visit by an ecologist that came down and walked through the Mile Around Woods and walked through the Lake Perrin area. And she was an ecologist for Middlebury and Green Mountain College, before it closed. And she ended her site visit with the term ecosystem collapse. And what she meant by that is that the woods in this area, just like many of the woods in Vermont and all of New England, are not regenerating. The trees, the shrubs, the other supporting plants that need to grow over time to replace the elderly trees that we have are not there now. You go into woods and you can see quite a distance in the woods because the ground is barren, denuded. And who's doing the denuding? The white-tailed deer, as one of the reasons. The white-tailed deer pressure in Vermont and in other New England states is enormous, and they preferentially eat native trees and shrubs. They do not love invasives, darn it. And so what has happened is there's been a real imbalance. So those two things put together, a steep decline in an indicator species, type of species, and a severe detriment to the habitat, meant that the fund could not look at their acreage and go, well, laissez-faire, you know, Mother Nature will take care of it. Well, probably she would have if we had let her alone, but we didn't. So we decided that we needed to start doing something about that. Oh, I have to read you, the reason I did this on paper is there's an Aldo Leopold quote about the damage that the deer do. He said, he's gazing out on this deer-blasted landscape, and he says, every edible bush and seedling browsed, every edible tree defoliated, as if someone had given God a new pruning shears and forbidden him to have any other exercise. So this is Leopold's view years ago. He was looking at Wisconsin, but it's the same dynamic. So the other thing that is causing this denuding and this problem is that we have this tsunami, this tidal wave of smothering and rapacious invasive plants. Now, these come up, the reason they're invasive and so good is they come up first, they spread incredibly quickly, they grow very fast, they spread by multiple means, seeds and rhizomes and leaf drop, and they have no natural controls, and they suppress native plants by hogging the sunlight and the water and the nutrients and the space. So when folks go for a walk early, like just maybe just at the very start of spring, barely spring, and you see the first flush of green, most folks say, oh, isn't that lovely? And I say, oh, no, because that green you're seeing, it's honeysuckle, it's barberry, it's bittersweet, it's multiflora rose, and it's that least favorite of mine, Euonymus salata, the burning bush. That was introduced by, speaking of which, most of these were introduced by humans. That was introduced as an ornamental plant and has belatedly been banned for sale in multiple states, especially in New England, because of this horrible environmental impact. We could talk about other invasives, but those are the big five that we're dealing with. So the forests are struggling with the legacies of past and the threats and stressors now and future things that no doubt are coming. Challenges that we haven't even seen yet. And so it was clear, because of this serious ecological need of wooded habitat, because of, as I discussed, the habitat loss is what has caused this decline in birds, and the damage to our woods, it was clear we had to do something to encourage natural generation, regeneration. So we wanted to make the woods, and we're focusing on woods here, we'll get to invasive grasses when we have a little time, but focusing on the woods now. Make it more resilient, make it more diverse, and make it a habitat that will support the interdependence of all species in that habitat. So the first year was very social, and I certainly got in all my steps on my Fitbit that year. We had multiple conservation and forest management organizations come down separately, independent visits, and we walked and we walked and we walked and we talked and we talked and we talked, and we learned a lot. And it was striking, actually, the unanimity across, you know, different organizations have different perspectives. Not so much. Everybody was using that horrible term, ecosystem collapse, and everybody was saying, if you want to do it right, here's really what you need to do, steps eight or whatever. So we took a deep breath and said, okay, here we go. So we committed to this 10-year plan. So the first year was social, and we actually did something on our own while we were doing that, is we started a grassland birds protection nesting area. Grassland birds like Savannah sparrow or bobolink. When we started this, the first year there was the report, people do bird walks, and there were three or four bobolink in that area. So we took 20 some acres and we said no mowing. We worked with our farmers and said no mowing of this grassy, cool season grasses. You can mow really early in May and then start to mow in August. But do not mow during that time during nesting and fledging. And the third year of that project, 50 bobolink took off for their arduous flight to Argentina, where they winter. And every year, you know, we just hold our breath to see that they'll come back to that area. So that was great. We worked at the Center of Eco Studies, who developed the global plan for grassland birds. And we worked with a great Bennington College ornithologist to help us with that project. So The next year was paperwork. So we couldn't afford this. So we wrote a grant for the Natural Conservation Resource organizations, part of the USDA, and said, could you please, at least, you know, the grants are great, but it's only partial reimbursement, and you have to pony up the money first, and then they give you some partial money back. So we wrote that grant to try to get some funding for that. The other paperwork is that we had to write a 10-year conservation plan and submit it to the state. That was 80 pages, so that took a little while, but yay, that's done, it's in place. I don't even want to think about how close we are to the, you have to do this every 10 years. Don't tell me it's coming down the pike. The next year, I like these one word things for the years, was the brontosaurus. Isn't that a great term? This is a 70,000 pound piece of equipment. It has a 2,000 pound spinning head. It can take a tree, a full-grown tree, down from crown to ground in a minute. Very expensive. So the point of stepping up for this piece of equipment is that the fund's property had towering hedgerows and edges of their forest that were solid invasives. I mean, solid. We had another ecologist come through and go through the hedgerows, and she stopped about 40 feet in, and she said, forget it. This is all, you know, that litany I did of bittersweet and barbarian. Yeah, that's what it was completely. I have a picture, I wish I could, maybe I'll send it to your website, of the guys that run this monster machine, and they're going, and this is their job. They love to do this. They love to just take this stuff out. So they came down to do a site visit first, and they're going, whoa! And they're, because these are 35 feet tall hedgerows, 20 feet wide. I mean, all invasives. It's horrible. They're thrilled. So anyway, so that year we took out 2.5 million cubic feet of invasives. That is a volume of about 50 railroad cars. So we didn't take them out. What we did, and this is why all of the ecology and conservation groups said, if you can afford to do this, this is the way to do it, because they mulch it. And so what happens is that all that yucca, technical term, it gets turned into ground litter that, you know, supports the soil and keeps erosion down, and it basically degrades over time. The other charm is that it smothers out the huge seed bank that we had, because all those invasives, they're dropping seeds all the time. And these seeds are the Cheetos of the woods, and the birds eat them, and then they get the backdoor trots, and they fly away, and then they drop the seeds. And we are in the migratory flyway. So the birds eating this crapola, excuse me, here fly north or fly south, and they're seeding literally these invasives up the flyway. Anyway, so the brontosaurus came, we chewed all this stuff down, it was a no-waste system, and so we were happy with that, and it was that we invited the local schools to come and watch from a very far distance, because this thing, I mean, it can pitch a piece of trunk, you know, like 30 feet. So that was that year. The next year was, we did a little bit more mulching, not with the brontosaurus. I was sorry, because it was kind of fun. But more planting. We planted in what we call the Monarch Meadow. That's another little habitat we have. We put in 200 supportive, pollinator supportive and shrubland bird supportive plants. Apparently, forest edge birds, so here's the forest and here's your meadow. They don't, you know, I mean, it's great to have a right angle, you know, but birds don't like that. They like a softened edge. So we planted a lot of those shrubs there, some of which are still alive, but some of them were, bingo, eaten by the deer. We weren't cheaping out, but this costs money, you know, so we put trunk protectors on it, but we didn't put shelters on them. And for a while, the deer did not figure it out, but they eventually came down and chowed a bit. But I would say we've got about a 60% survival rate there. So we're watching this all the time. All of this stuff is documented. I have a drone that I use that never takes a picture of a human, by the way. But it's every season, I take pictures of the work that we're being that's being done. The school is being engaged, the village school. They do a lot of art projects linked with this. And the Bennington College contributes, and their classes work with us as well. So that was the mulching. The next year, and we're now into, we're up to this last year. No, we're last year. So the reason we were so busy on doing a lot of mulching is that we actually wanted the seed bank to get weakened. We wanted the seeds that are sitting there to start to grow up, because then you can see them before they're 35 feet tall, and you can take them out. You can take them out by hand pulling, and you take them out by backpack spraying. And yes, we used herbicide. We used herbicide on these small plants. It was a nozzle herbicide, focal, local, no wind, no drift, and at a dose that was 4% of what herbicide is used to prepare a standard corn planting field. So that was, every organization told us that nobody's going to tell you that they love to use herbicides, but if you do not get that new flush out, you threw your money away. You're shooting yourself in the foot. At the same time, we had had a community meeting about our fields. We were moving from one lease to another and asked people, what do you think we should do with the fields? And there were a lot of interesting, some of them practical, some of them less practical ideas, two of which we adopted. One was that we stopped doing corn of any sort. The whole goal of this is to improve the habitat and to encourage natural regeneration, and that means not having corn, not having herbicides on the land. So we stopped any corn planting. We used herbicides to kill the thing that was stopping the goals that we had, at, as I said, at 4% of what it would have taken one field of herbicide. And we continued to plant. So that was 2023. Last year, this last winter, we put the no corn policy in place. We did the low growth treatment, and we planted 400 in Lake Perrin. By the way, behind Lake Perrin, I tried to get two foresters to look at that area, and they both said the same thing. I don't know what this is about, echo chambers, but the separate meetings, and they said, well, I can't tell you what's in there. You have a 13-acre impenetrable thicket of honeysuckle. And I thought, that's descriptive. And then the next forester that came said, you have a, I was like, what is going on here? So anyway, so we mulched that, and we put in all the honeysuckle, and we cut it again the second year, and we planted there as well. So this year, we planted at Lake Perrin, in the back, and at the Mile Around Woods, up to 1,000 shrubs and trees. And if you take a walk in the Mile Around Woods now, we also ponied up for shelters for these. It doubles the cost of a planting to do this, to build the shelters. We're using two shelter types, kind of a little experiment to see which one's going to do better. One of style is, to me, regrettably colorful. I mean, light blue like the sky. But so whenever you see it, you say, there's a shelter, but yay, there's a healthy tree in there. So those are going to have to stay in place for 3 years. They're going to have to stay there long enough for the saplings to get large enough that the deer say, can't be bothered. So we now have, when you walk in the Mile Round Woods, you can see where you're going because there are a lot of shelters of these trees. We planted white pine, serviceberry, hazelnut, elderberry, paper birch, persimmon, quaking aspen, red oak, dogwood, shagbark, sugar maple, hardnuts, butternuts, and chestnuts. The chestnuts are blight-resistant chestnuts. We have basically a wood glen, or I'm not quite sure what we should call it. You guys should come up and give me a name. This is the first time these species of chestnuts, as you remember, the chestnut blight took out our core tree in North America. So we've put about 50 in place throughout the Mile Around Woods. They're well caged. The village school is linked with it. They're going to be studying the concept of chestnuts and ecosystems. So we like to include those folks. And on the other side, that was another idea we got from the community meeting, to do silviculture, which is using your fields to plant trees that are productive. And again, all of these things that we're planting are supportive of pollinators. We don't have time to talk about pollinators and their problems, but that's one of the goals. And also wildlife support trees and shrubs. Shrubs that provide shelter. Shrubs that are the right configuration for nesting. Shrubs that produce food for wildlife, all sorts of wildlife. We had a number of people when we took the hedgerows down, besides the people who said, well, I don't know where to walk now. I was, okay, well, just kind of go where you went before. But the problem with the hedgerows, they'd had some charms. They provided shade for some critters. They were a corridor for the wildlife, because we have woodlands on either side of those fields. So right now, the wildlife corridor got removed. So we're really planting along that area so that we can help wildlife move, escape, do territorial stuff, mate in different areas. So those are slowly growing up. We've had a lot of other organizations and individuals help us with this. As I mentioned, the two schools, volunteers come and pull out the garlic mustard. We have an incredible garlic mustard SWAT team that has been fantastic over decades. And I hope you all come in the spring, because not early when it's just the haze of the invasives, but later on in the spring for all the ephemeral flowers in the Mile Around Woods, it's just lovely. And it's very rare, actually, that we have as much of a flush of those as we do. Do any of you know the app Merlin? Phone app Merlin? Yeah. Yes! Use Merlin. The other group of people that are helping us are those that are using this very simple and fun system. Can you hear a bird and it says, that's a towhee or something. And that data is shared with Cornell's ornithology group. And they're the ones that are doing the serious science on species management and control. So you're being a citizen scientist. It's a brilliant system. That and iNaturalist as well. I am terrible at, oh, gee, look at that, you know, critter. I mean, mostly invertebrates. I'm not great at invertebrates. But iNaturalist can tell you right away. Simple, free, citizen science. Please, everybody use it. Any information you can send is useful.